Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Anderson, registration number 14907. I'm with the law firm of Burns, Figa, and Will, and I represent Milton Zale, trustee of the Milton Zale Trust, dated December 18, 1980. Mr. Zale is with us in the courtroom today, and with me at council table is Hillary Anderson of Burns, Figa, and Will. I'd also like to thank the court for the extra 5 minutes for oral argument this morning so we can address the issues that the court brought up. The court, in its recent clarification order, asked the question of whether the orders of June 15, 2007 and July 22, 2009 together constitute an ultimate disposition of an entire claim for relief. And the answer is yes, they do. And the main reason for that is because the trial court has nothing left to do. If this court were to remand this claim back to the trial court, there'd be nothing for the trial court to do. There's no facts that the trial court needs to find. The third claim for relief, as I believe the court knows, is just addressed to whether the one-story restriction is enforceable. And that's a one-story restriction that is enforceable only by the Rodells against the Zale property. Now, there's a number of other parties and a number of other claims in the case at the trial court. None of those have anything to do with the one-story restriction. These are the only parties that are involved here.
And so can I ask you a couple questions about that third claim for relief?
Yes.
Excuse me. As I read it, it also mentions something about the contract restrictions, which are mentioned in the first and second claims for relief, and I guess together constitute a cause of action that sort of centers on the landscaping. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, that may be what that said, but those issues have all been put by the wayside. Everything else has been settled between Mr. Zale and the Rodells.
Only
the one-story restriction.
But is it significant that as embodied in the third claim for relief, the contract restrictions were dismissed without prejudice?
I don't think that's significant at all. It doesn't have anything to do with the one-story restriction here, which the parties agree is what's at issue here, and what was certified for review by this court from the trial court below, Rule 54B.
On the one-story restriction, here I'm going to paraphrase, but it seems to me that the claim contains several elements. What the complaint asked is that the and also as embodied in the motion for partial summary judgment, that there is a one-story restriction and that it's enforceable against the Zale property by the Rodells, and that the proposed structure violates that one-story restriction. Is that a fair characterization of that claim?
That's right. That's what they said at the time.
Okay. The court's order granting partial summary judgment does not expressly indicate whether the proposed structure violates the one-story restriction. Is that correct?
Well, I think what the court order did was stop Zale from continuing his construction of the property and said that the one-story restriction was valid, that did terminate the construction.
Really? Because I'm not seeing that in the court's order.
I thought the court specifically at one point declined to enter any kind of injunctive order.
Well, the injunction was a different claim for relief. That was the fourth claim for relief. The trial court here specifically found that the phrase one story is not ambiguous, and that either explicitly or implicitly said that Mr. Zale could not continue construction of his house.
Why?
Because it was in violation of the one-story restriction.
Where does the court say that? I guess it's the question that we're struggling with.
Okay. I think the order has to be viewed in context with the motion. And the motion requested that the court find that Zale was in violation of the one-story restriction.
Well, actually, no, it didn't. The motion for partial summary judgment, so I can find the actual language here.
It says, the Rodells are entitled to a declaration that the one-story restriction is valid, that it binds defendant, and it is enforceable by the Rodells. The Rodells are similarly entitled to a permanent injunction stopping defendant from proceeding with the multi-story house that defendant plans to build.
So in those two sentences, nowhere is a request that the court declare that the proposed structure violates the one-story restriction.
Well, that's certainly been the view of the parties all along, because the Rodells wanted to prevent Mr. Zale from constructing what he planned to construct.
Of course.
And a motion to stop it, and the court granted the motion, it says in the first paragraph of the court's order.
Well, I can definitely understand why you would think that the declaration is implicit in the request for an injunction. The court presumably could not enter an injunction unless it also determines necessarily that the dwelling violates the one-story restriction. But, of course, the court declined to enter the injunction, and it declared only that the restriction is valid and binds the defendant, right? I mean, I don't see that it actually declares the relief that is listed as one of the elements of the third claim for relief.
Well, maybe he didn't say so in so many words, but I think that was certainly the effect. I don't know what the other effect would be. What could possibly be the other alternative? If it didn't do that, what did it do?
As I understand it, it just liquidated the argument that the restriction in the abstract was too vague to be enforceable.
Okay, and we're saying that it is too vague to be enforceable.
A legitimate argument, but
that's an issue for this court.
But it doesn't. But I don't see how that it completely settles the entire claim for relief that's presented in that complaint.
What would be left for the court to do?
Declare whether it violates the one-story restriction, whether the house violates the one-story restriction, declare that it's enforceable by the Rodells. Those are two elements that the court has yet to determine.
Well, I think, we have a second order that also says that the one-story restriction is valid. It one-story means one-story.
Right.
And that's where we're left. The relief that Zale wants is broader than just saying that those plans are comply with the one-story restriction. The issue here is whether the one-story restriction is so vague and ambiguous that it ought to be set aside completely, regardless of what the plans were in the first place.
Yes, I understand that's the party's position, but I guess what I don't see is a claim for relief requesting that alone. I see a claim for relief that's really directed against a particular dwelling. And also, I have to wonder, when the court declined to enter an injunction, it did so presumably because, expressly declined to do it because it said it had yet to settle defenses such as unclean hands and equitable estoppel, etc. Correct?
That's what the court order says.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, isn't that necessarily reserving question on whether the one-story restriction is enforceable by the Rodells?
That was directed just towards the injunction, and that has nothing to do with the argument that we have here, that this one sentence buried in an exception to a warranty clause provision of a form transfer deed is ambiguous. That's where the action is here, we believe. That's what the claim was addressed at the district court, and that's on appeal here to the Colorado Court of Appeals. There really is nothing left for the court to do. If this court sends the case back to the district court, we have no plans, no intention of bringing up these unclean hands and other defenses here. The question, and it's brief for the court, it's ready for analysis, it's ready for decision, is whether this one-story restriction is too vague to be enforceable here because of the ambiguities.
I appreciate your attempt to bring closure to this claim. Does the record establish that the defendants will forego the equitable defenses that the court reserved ruling on?
Well, if the record doesn't, I can do it right now, if that's the concern.
I don't know that that's enough, but assuming that it is, and then will the record also establish that the one-story restriction, that the proposed dwelling violated the one-story restriction? Does the record contain a stipulation by the defendants to that effect?
I don't think there's a specific stipulation to that effect, but certainly that's what all the argument has been about in two separate summary judgment motions at the district court, and of course the briefing before this court now. I just am at a loss to understand what the district court would do if this court sends it back there. There's nothing for it to do. The case has been certified. The district court made all the findings that are required by the jurisprudence of this court and the Colorado Supreme Court under Rule 54B, the claim has been completely adjudicated. There's no reason to delay, and the parties can continue. And the issue is ripe for this court to review it.
Well, let's proceed then to the merits. What is it that you think the court has decided so far?
Well, the court decided that the one-story restriction is not vague, not ambiguous, and is fully enforceable. And we disagree with that for the reasons stated in the brief.
So what is it about, and as I understand it, there was a plan, some building plans, which have now been, as I understand your brief, scrapped. And according to your brief, your client's got to go back to ground zero. Or start over.
That's right.
So in my own mind, I'm wondering why this case isn't moot, but let me get beyond that and say, what is your understanding of what was objectionable about the plan that created this lawsuit in the first place?
Well, the Rodells thought that it was a multi-story structure.
I understand that, but what specifically do you understand that objection to mean? How was it a multi-story structure, and how did it violate this particular restriction?
Well, in their view, the structure was three levels. There was a subterranean level with a garage in it. There was another level that was partially open and partially covered by the ground because this is a sloping lot. And there's another level, and you can see this from the plans that are attached to the summary judgment motion. There's another level that's completely above ground. And, in fact, if you look at the building from one side, it looks like a one-story building because that's all you can see. If you come around to the other side, then you can see the other levels. And the problem is trying to figure out what the one-sentence statement in this deed from 1973 means with respect to things like basements, for example. Because houses are referred to in Colorado all the time that may be a single-story ranch structure with a basement underneath it as a one-story house, but it's got two levels. You can have a two-story house. It's called a two-story house. It's got two levels above ground. It's got a full basement. Three-level house. It's two stories. The Rodells argue that a basement would violate the one-story restriction.
Is the objection that it's a basement or that it's a walkout basement?
Both. They would object to both. As the court will recall from the briefing, the opening brief listed a number of design features, basement being one of them, walkout basement being another one, sunken living room, some high bookshelves with a ladder to reach the upper bookshelves, a garage that may be on a level different than the living area. And the Rodells responded in their answer brief at page 19 and said all of those violate the one-story restriction. So the issue that we would be facing here, if the current plans are not going to be built, then Mr. Zale would have to go back and present some new plans, and then we'd be back with the objections. Oh, well, this has a sunken living room. We can't do that, and we're over to the district court in Aspen, acting as a building review board instead of a district court. This is why this issue is fully briefed. It's ready for disposition by this court, and for the reasons I've stated, is just too ambiguous to be enforced.
Counsel, there's a maximum in the law, of course, that every term, every phrase is ambiguous to some extent, you know, and that depending on the context and depending on the problem that the court is trying to solve, we can view language as fatally ambiguous or perfectly clear. Your position seems to be, and obviously there are ambiguities in this one-story restriction, is it your position that because of these ambiguities, the provision is simply unenforceable, and but for a height restriction, you could go ahead and build a 15-story building?
Well, the parties have agreed to a specific height restriction.
Okay, well, let's set that aside and just focus on the meaning of the one-story restriction. I can see where ambiguities about whether you can build a building or not could be construed strictly, in favor of the maximum use of the land. But it would seem hard to construe the one-story restriction and say, well, it's ambiguous, and therefore you can build a 20-story building.
Well, a 20-story building, that's not going to happen. It's in Aspen. There's going to be a very strict review of this from the city of Aspen.
I understand it as
a
practical matter.
So that's not going to happen.
But you understand the nature of my question?
Well, that's right. But the thing is that the alternative to that is to have the district court turn into the planning review board. That the Riddells have already indicated that they're going to object to everything. They're going to object to a sunken living room one step below the rest. That's why these things get voided completely rather than have to play this game of Mother May I that, well, let's see, will today's plans work, that sort of thing. And the Colorado Supreme Court and the Colorado Legislature have directed this court to view these things in a manner that all doubts are reserved, are construed against the restriction and in favor of free use of the property. And I think because of the myriad questions here and all of the fairly innocuous design features that are discussed that the Riddells have said they've objected to, it's obvious that reasonable people can disagree as to what that one-story restriction means with respect to a whole myriad of different things. And therefore, yes, the court should void the whole restriction. I mean, this is not a building restriction that's in the context of some well-thought-out plan or some multi-page covenants that people have thought about and drafted and used before and have a plan for the entire neighborhood. This is a single sentence in a warranty deed, a form deed that is just placed in there. I mean, it's in an area for discussion of reservation of warranties. And in fact, there's even a statement that says that Chicago Title Insurance Company hereby insures against loss for various things. I mean, Chicago Title Insurance Company is not a party to this at all. It's a sloppy deed. It's stuck in there at the end, and it's tying up valuable real estate in the state of Colorado. And I think the direction from this court, from the legislature and the Colorado Supreme Court, is to get rid of these kind of things. Well, I'd like to reserve my last minute and 20 seconds, unless the court has any other questions for me right now.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lance Cote. My registration number is 18194, and I'm from the Aspen law firm of Klein, Cote, and Edwards. And we represent the Riddells. Marjorie Riddell is in the courtroom this morning. In listening to counsel's argument, I'd like to jump right to the point of we have not said that we disapprove of everything. What we've said is the definition of one story can't be read to mean, for example, you can't have a tall ladder. It's ridiculous in our view to say one story means a house with a tall ladder, a house with a short ladder. It's something that needs to be excluded from the definition of one story. So we're not saying, you know, if Mr. Zale came and said, oh, I want to build a house that has a tall ladder, you know, these are reasonable people. They've already resolved their differences on the height restriction. You know, obviously that is not part of the definition of one story.
But let me go back to the question that I pursued then, and the briefs call into question whether there's reason here on either side. But nonetheless, going back to the original plan that was apparently objected to by your clients that then led to this lawsuit, give me specifically what it was about those plans that caused your clients to object on the grounds that the plans violated the one-story restriction. That's all I'm talking about now. And how?
I can answer that.
Okay.
If you see the plans, they have one level, two levels, three levels, and an elevator that goes up, and then a rooftop deck.
Is the elevator visible from outside, from your client's house?
No.
Okay, so why are you objecting to the elevator?
Well, I'm mentioning the elevator. I'm not objecting to an elevator. I mean, you can have an elevator that goes nowhere. I'm not objecting to an elevator. I'm suggesting that an elevator demonstrates that you have a house of more than one story.
Okay, you mentioned levels. Okay. Again, my specific question is, what is it about the design, and it's not good enough just to tell me there are several levels, what is it about the design that violates the one-story restriction, and how does it violate that in such a way that it affects your client?
There is a horizontal separation in the structure. There are three horizontal separations in the structure, that each of which I think is what we call a story, colloquially. So from the floor to the ceiling above is a horizontal separation. And then on top of that you have another floor to ceiling.
How many of those, what you're calling stories, are above ground?
Well, all of them are above ground. This is the thing, is if you look at the plans, the best thing to look at, there was a photograph attached to the motion for clarification filed by the appellant. And the last page of the exhibit to that motion shows a picture of what the lot looks like right now. And what you have is not a sloping lot, it's just a dugout lot that's down to almost street level. Completely flat. Then behind it, it goes straight up, and then there's a retaining wall, and then the Rodell's house is above, right on top of what's behind what looks at this lot. So if you stand on the street in front of Mr. Zale's lot, and you have three horizontal divisions, you will see a three-story house.
At what the Rodell's see from their house?
Well, it depends where you stand on the lot. But if you stand on the far end of their lot, they can't see it. If you stand on their backyard, which is looking down at it, you will see it go all the way down. Now, it's up close, so it's not like from here to the pillar where you can say, okay, da-da-da-da-da, right, boom, boom, boom. But if you stand close, which is, to look down, you will see all three from the lot.
So depending on where you stand, it looks like a one-story or a three-story.
Right. Well, from the outside, everything looks like a one-story, doesn't it? I mean, from the outside, you don't see, unless the windows are open, you don't see. I mean, we're not saying a one-story house can't be, 50 feet tall. You could have a one-story house that's 50 foot tall. It has nothing to do with how tall it is. It's how many horizontal divisions are present between levels.
How does that affect your client?
Well, my client believes that the reduction of horizontal levels reduces the square footage available for use of the premises. Go ahead.
But you could have, by all appearances, what appears to be a simple ranch, single-story ranch house that is not more than 20 feet tall in any place, but several levels below that, subterranean levels, and your client would object on the ground that allows for more use than would otherwise be present.
That is correct.
Okay. So let me be really specific then and make sure that I understand that. let's say that above ground you had what everybody would concede to be a ranch-style house. All the rooms were at one level. And below that, you had a 10,000-square-foot basement with all kinds of rooms, but it was totally subterranean. Nobody could see it from the outside. Right. Would you object to that as violating the one-story restriction?
This would, in fact, be a two-story house. We would object because it's not how it looks. The height restriction, the separate height restriction, resolves that whole issue of how tall it is. Right. So this is not, this fight that we're having now, it's not about how tall it is or how it looks like to the outside. It's about how many horizontal divisions there are that create additional square footage to burden the lot and the neighborhood.
Now, what is it, in your view, that the court did with these arguments?
Well, originally, Judge Ruland, when he looked at it, he was dealing with the issues raised at the time by Mr. Zale's then counsel that, oh, there are issues of fact that we have to resolve about changes in the neighborhood or building techniques that would, as applied, make this now ambiguous. And I believe that's what Judge Ruland did, was consider that those arguments.
And liquidated those in your favor.
Yeah.
Saying essentially, no, the one-story restriction is still valid, notwithstanding changes in condition, right. And it means one story.
Correct.
But now, again, strictly speaking, that doesn't tell us much about the present arguments, about whether, in fact, wasn't it in response to the appellant's arguments that you would be willing, that you said you would be willing to stipulate for purposes of that motion, that a basement would be appropriate?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
we did, yes.
Okay, so at least as far as Judge Ruland's concerned,
right.
The court has yet to resolve anything about that.
Right.
Okay.
Right. No, and that was the state of that order. And,
all right.
And I am prepared to talk about the issue that you were just asking about the status of the injunction and what the court would still have to do.
Let's go on and just briefly then describe what additionally was then decided by Judge Lynch on this issue.
Well, in my reading of her order, she basically declined to reconsider the Judge Ruland order on the grounds that Allen somehow called all story restrictions, height restrictions. As I read it, she just rejected that and said, no, we're not going to do that. So that if we, shall I go on?
Well, only at this point, in your view, has a court yet decided whether what looks to be a one-story structure with a basement violates the one-story restriction or not? Has a court yet decided that?
No, not as applied. If I can say as applied, what they said was one story means in the plain language is what we apply. That's what Judge Ruland said.
Yes.
Is we look at the plain language of one story. He says I understand what a one story house is, so it's not ambiguous. Now he didn't go on to say, you know, this house doesn't meet this, and if you did this, and all these hypotheticals that we've heard, he doesn't address any of those. And I know Judge Lynch doesn't either. What he said was, you guys still can put on your case that there's defenses when this comes to trial. Right? All I'm saying is it's not ambiguous.
Well, okay, but I would certainly understand his statements to be liquidations of the arguments about changed conditions and perhaps an argument about the one-story restriction being too vague in the abstract to be enforceable. But it doesn't really solve the question about whether the ambiguities raised by the appellant in the brief, whether those are permissible or not permissible. For example, we don't know yet whether a two-story, what you would call a two-story mm-hmm. restriction structure, what they would call a one-story, one above, one below ground, would be a one-story structure within the meaning of this deed.
Right. That has not been determined. That has not been determined. And as counsel said, I mean, we've all sort of acted as if that had been determined, in the sense that, well, whatever was decided, this one that's attached, you know, to the motion with the multiple and the elevator, that probably isn't a go under any circumstances.
Again, the court didn't specifically declare that.
Specifically say
that. All right. Okay. And now, let me ask you about this, because this seems to be in some ways related to the claim that you brought. When I read that claim, I do not see a request for the court to define what this one-story restriction means precisely. I rather see this listed among other building restrictions in an attempt to invalidate the proposed structure that the plaintiff, that the defendants had.
Right. Unquestionably, our tactical decision at the time was to stop. I mean, the construction, you know, the hole was being dug, foundation was being poured. We had to stop this thing that was being built, right? And both for the height restriction and the one-story restriction. So yes, our claim was stop this multi-story building that exceeds the height restriction in our interpretation. And so, that was the focus of the claim. As this thing evolved over how many years to where, you know, we got to the point of, you know, the short building season in Aspen is that, you know, several seasons got missed, and all of a sudden it wasn't as urgent anymore for, you know, Mr. Zale to build that particular house. So it's we sort of lost sight, I guess, in the course of the trial court litigation of that particular design. And we had this order that said, subject to equitable defenses, the one-story restriction is enforceable. And that, I think, the parties took as a guide to future conduct as opposed to a complete resolution of all issues. And I think it also, in some way, probably contributed to the settlement of the height restriction. You're absolutely right. If you look at it now and say, yeah, well, this all wasn't really decided, well, okay, that is true. But I also want to say on the issue of what wasn't decided is in the opening brief of Mr. Zale, on page 8, he lists all these things, and he referred to them in his argument about, oh, well, in Colorado there's this, and, you know, it's frequently referred to as that. But there's no evidence in the record for any of that. And if we got sent back, I imagine there would be testimony, expert witnesses on all that, as you say, to determine whether this specific property did, in fact, violate the one-story restriction. And so to say that there's nothing to do when we go back, where we are going to be when we go back fighting what he's saying on page 8 of his brief about facts that aren't in the record. So to that extent, if you send this back, that there will be a fight on that issue.
Well, I'm trying to grasp with the reality of what we've got in front of us here, which is a bit perplexing. As I understand it, you've got an order in your pocket that says this clause, this one-story restriction is unambiguous. One story means one story. That's what you've got.
Yes.
And as I understand what Mr. Zale would like is for us to say, no, whatever it means, the whole clause is ambiguous, and it just simply doesn't exist anymore. It's void. It's gone.
Yeah.
And that's how you guys are presenting the issue to us, kind of as a, it's almost like an advisory opinion, regardless of whatever plans there are.
Well, I guess if I could just sort of generally address that comment, we probably agree that the first test you apply in determining if there's an ambiguity here is not how old the deed was or how complicated the restrictions are or this kind of thing. It just doesn't meet the plain language test. Does an ordinary person understand what this means? Now, so when you say, well, we have this order in our pocket, I mean, I think that's what Judge Rulon did.
Yes, no, I understand that.
He said, this meets that test, and that's all I'm deciding, and you guys good luck and, you know, go on. Now, it is an advisory. I mean, I understand why you're saying it's an advisory opinion, because you foresee a future fight that hasn't happened yet.
Exactly.
Right. And you know, I can't deny that that's true, that there won't be a future disagreement or at least a future confrontation about, you know, plans.
Is there, from a legal standpoint, I'm just trying to understand the kind of the framework here, and I'm not suggesting that's where we would go. I'm just trying to understand what our options are. Is there a middle ground? I mean, is there a middle ground to say, well, it's ambiguous. We're not going to declare it void. It's ambiguous, and it's got to go back for evidence on how to resolve that ambiguity, which I guess you would do by looking at intent and all kinds of other construction mechanisms that the trial court would have in front of it.
I would hesitate to agree because what we would be doing then is be putting the same advisory opinion into the trial court. Because until there's some concrete case or controversy, I have these plans, this is what I want to build. The trial court can't do that either, right? I mean, all the trial court has been able to do so far is say, I think I know what a one-story house is. Right? Now when you guys come back and you show me something, I'll be able to tell you because I know what a one-story house is. Well, it won't be that hard at all. So I think that to say in advance that there's a possible ambiguity that could arise really is an advisory opinion at this level and suggesting that the district court make the same advisory opinion.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, but just so I'm clear, and I appreciate your characterization of the court's ruling, what we have so far is a ruling that says, I think I know what a one-story restriction is. I think it's sufficiently plain. Does that completely resolve the claim for relief, the cause of action that was embodied in that third claim for relief, that statement, that ruling?
In the third claim for relief, what happened was Mr. Zale withdrew those plans, and so it became moot.
Now, does the record establish that he withdrew the plans, that there is no attempt to build those plans? And does that just moot the entire case?
I don't think it moots. Well, first question first. In the record, I think there was a reference to the fact probably the stipulation on the 54B certification that the other issues had been resolved, but I'm not sure if there was a specific sentence that said, and he withdrew his plans. I don't remember for sure if that was in there. And if not, I can see why you're confused.
Well, because again, as I said, yeah. It looks to me that, and again, let me just, your complaint has got seven claims for relief, but it looks to embody about four causes of action. One is a building claim against Zale. Another, if I'm right, is a building claim against property owners other than Zale. These are other lots that are. Is that accurate?
There was a lot of fighting about that. What we said was we were ordered to join everybody else, and what we said was that they had the right to enforce. It was a general plan, not the one-story restriction, but the height restriction was a part of a general plan in the community from the 50s, and that they all had a right to enforce it against Mr. Zale, and that Mr. Zale, therefore, was entitled to have them present any claims against him at that time.
Okay, but what is the cause of action that would be embodied in the seventh claim for relief?
That was that claim.
Okay.
Yes.
Then there's also a sort of what appears to be a landscaping claim.
Right, that was that settlement agreement.
And then a trespass claim, for lack of better
word. Yes.
Okay, so when its order says...
Don't worry about your time. We're going to let you go.
When its order says this completely resolves the third claim for relief...
Yes.
I gather what the court means is this completely resolves the building claim against Zale, not the portion of the third claim for relief based on the contract restrictions, which really have to do with the landscaping claim.
You know, I would have to say that... if you sent us back, you might be right. Because if we lost this issue, if there were other elements in there, then we would want to revisit those. I mean, so let's say that the summary judgment got vacated. Now we're back to go try the third claim. yeah, I think these things are on the table.
But they are in ways we could possibly view them as unrelated causes of action, but in some ways they are related. They're certainly related to the proposed project.
Definitely in that way, no question.
Okay.
And whatever future proposed project it would be related to.
But viewing the light most favorable to finality, we could separate that third claim for relief. And then I understand that you have dismissed with prejudice your reliance on any building restrictions other than the one-story restriction.
Right, and okay. We substitute it with a settlement agreement.
Now, in your view, did I fairly characterize it? You wanted a declaration that there was this restriction, that it was enforceable in the abstract mm-hmm. against Zale, and it was enforceable by your client.
Yes.
And in denying the injunction, didn't the court necessarily decline to reach that issue?
But I thought that... I thought that in the brief... back in the Judge Ruland order, I thought in that brief that they had conceded the issue that if it existed, it was enforceable, or that it was in fact, that the sentence was in the deed and it was on its face enforceable by them, but that we shouldn't enforce it for the various reasons. I didn't think that was actually disputed back in the first summary judgment. As I read their opposition brief. Now, I don't know that Judge Ruland actually recited that.
No,
But I think that they, and I don't know that if it's an actual waiver or admission, I just think that it's not a fight that they chose to have at that time. Now, if it wasn't an express, oh, I admit, then yes, I guess if we went back to trial, they could dispute that. But as you'll see, nobody has actually raised that issue ever. And I think it was because, well, it is in the deed and it does say that you get to enforce it. And so it really wasn't a fertile ground for a contest. But it doesn't mean that, you know, now fresh eyes won't see something there if we got sent back to the trial court.
Yeah. I appreciate your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Cote. We appreciate
it.
Mr. Anderson, I'm going to ask the bailiff to add about another 3 minutes, if you would like it, for your rebuttal, just because we went on a little longer with Mr. Cote.
Okay, thank you very much. I think perhaps part of the problem here is maybe focusing a little too closely on the pleadings and specifically what they say. I think the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure view pleadings as a little bit more malleable, that there are rules about how if something wasn't specifically pled and it's tried, it can be, you know, the pleadings can conform to the evidence. There's other rules about how you don't have to necessarily use specific words or phrases to get your claim out there. If you describe it enough, that's close enough. So things can change somewhat between the day that the complaint is filed and the day that you're finished at the district court. And I think that's a way to look at what happened here, is that the pleadings may focus on one thing, but the way it ended up going through the trial court and getting to the 54B certification and then on this court's desk is that the issue as it ended up getting refined and defined was whether this one single-story restriction is ambiguous and enforceable. And I think that there's plenty of leeway in the Colorado court, Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure to get to that point. That's what the parties relied on, and that's how it's come to this court, and it's perfectly appropriate for this court to make a decision and a ruling as to whether that one-story restriction is ambiguous or not. It's pretty obvious that if this court sends it back to the district court without deciding that, we'll probably be back here again in a couple of years with all of the same arguments. And I just don't think that is efficient for anybody. It's not efficient for this court. It's not efficient for the district court. It's certainly not efficient for the parties. Mr. Zale, in his affidavit that he attached to the motion for 54B certification, which was attached to our motion for clarification that we filed with this court a couple weeks ago, details the problems and expenses that he's had trying to fight his way through this quagmire. His construction was stopped back in early 2007. We're almost 4 years down the line from there. I think that Mr. Zale at this point deserves and is entitled to a ruling on the merits here. And let's move on with other cases, with Mr. Zale's life, with Rodell's life, and that sort of thing.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Cote, and that is, from a practical standpoint, given the where we are in this case now, am I reading it correctly that, I was asking whether there was a middle ground here, whether the, from a legal standpoint, one possible thing is to say, well, this is ambiguous, and it's got to go back to have the court determine intent and what it really means. But as I'm hearing the parties saying, you think it's one extreme or the other. Either it's the way the trial court decided it, or it's the way you would like us to decide it, which is it's so ambiguous that as a matter of law, it's simply not enforceable.
I think that's right. If it's ambiguous, it's not enforceable.
Well, that,
and, as far as intent, well, we don't know. The law is pretty clear that the only person whose intent counts is Mr. Barnard, and he's apparently not around. We don't know what he meant.
So let me ask you about that. I'm aware of cases that talk about the need to strictly construe these in favor of unrestricted use, which would mean that any ambiguity would be liquidated in favor of unrestricted use.
Right.
Your position seems to be that any ambiguity is fatal. Can you give me a case that would support that proposition?
Well, I think the cases that we cited, certainly the Allen case, is and that's what happened there. That restriction was struck down because of the loft issue. The Allen case also lists quite a few other cases from around the country that found one-story restrictions to be void and unenforceable. And so I direct the court direct the court's attention to those. I see, my time is up unless there's any other questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. We appreciate you taking the time today. Case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.